unite American society around a common project. We trust him to do that. Meanwhile, Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General who was due to have a dinner with Mike Pompeo, had described the scenes in Washington as shocking. Jens Stoltenberg said, "The outcome of this democratic election must be respected." A NATO spokesperson confirmed that Mike Pompeo had cancelled on Tuesday, 12th of January, giving as a reason the need to focus on the transition of power in Washington. Meanwhile, the Reuters news agency reported that European Union officials had declined to meet Mike Pompeo on his last foreign trip. But a European Union spokesperson denied there had been any plan or request for meetings with EU leaders. The US State Department in a statement attributed the cancellation to transition work before President-elect Joe Biden takes office on 20th of January, even if, until recently, Mike Pompeo had been reluctant to unequivocally recognize Joe Biden's election win. Also on Tuesday, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Kelly Craft, canceled a planned visit to Taiwan. The U.S. State Department declined further comment on European officials' rejection of meetings with Mike Pompeo. The cold shoulder was a contrast with Mike Pompeo's previous visits to Brussels, which is home to NATO and the European Union headquarters. Over the past 3 years, where he has given keynote speeches on US policy and met the EU's chief executive, even as Europe balked at Donald Trump's foreign policy. Meanwhile, US Vice President Mike Pence, in a letter to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, said he will not invoke the 25th Amendment. This means Congress will begin impeachment proceedings on Wednesday, 13th of January. Four Republican representatives, including third-ranking GOP member Liz Cheney, have said they'll vote to impeach Donald Trump. The President of the United States summoned this mob, assembled this mob, and lit the flame of this attack, Liz Cheney said. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has been named as impeachment managers. Representative Jamie Raskin will be taking lead, working with Diana DeGette, David Cicilline, Joaquin Castro, Eric Swalwell, Ted Lieu, Stacey Plaskett, Joe Nagusa, and Madeleine Dean. Representatives for the FBI and the Justice Department said more than 160 case files have been opened in connection to the violence at the Capitol building in Washington. Michael Sherwin, the acting U.S. attorney in D.C., said that alleged rioters face a mind-blowing range of crimes, including felony, murder, and sedition, as well as conspiracy. Also, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has told colleagues that he believes Donald Trump committed impeachable offenses, according to the New York Times. Mitch McConnell has also said that he's glad the House is moving forward with impeachment because he thinks it will make it easier to push Donald Trump out of the Republican Party.
European News Bulletin.
Hello everyone, my name is Amina Taylor and we're broadcasting from the British capital, and we begin this broadcast with our top story. Now, the House of Representatives is expected to hold a vote on impeaching U.S. President Donald Trump a little bit later, as Democrats and several Republican politicians accused the U.S. president of encouraging his supporters to storm the U.S. Capitol building in an attack that so far left five dead. President Trump has dismissed the accusations, labeling them ridiculous, and stated that his speech before last week's Capitol Hill riots was, quote, totally appropriate. The news comes just a day after Vice President Mike Pence rejected the Democrats' bill to invoke the 25th Amendment, which would force the U.S. president from office. Meanwhile, tough security measures are being put in place across Washington, D.C., ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's 20th of January inauguration, including the placement of anti-climb fences around the Capitol building. This just days after authorities revealed that there could be three separate plots to attack the Capitol ahead of the inauguration. Well, Kirst Banbury, the author and political commentator, joins us now for his take on this developing story. Are we going to see history being made by Donald Trump here, but perhaps, Chris, not the history he would have liked?
Well, I think it's going to be a bit more long haul than that. Firstly, the House of Representatives has to vote in favour of this amendment. Then it has to go to the Senate. For the Senate to initiate impeachment, it needs a two-thirds majority. Now, there's talk of leaving that vote in the Senate till the 19th of January, when the new Senate, which has a very, well, not a 50-50, but it gives the Democrats more hope. But a two-thirds majority, when the Democrats basically have 50%, rely on the casting votes of the Speaker, to get another, that requires a big tranche of Republican votes. And we're seeing some Republicans, yes, coming over to say they now support impeachment, but it would take a big number of Republicans to do that. The second factor in it as well is whether or not Joe Biden wants this to happen prior to his inauguration as president. Remember, Biden's priority is to show that he is the voice of mainstream America, the champion of democracy, etc. And in many ways, his priority is making sure he gets into the White House, he gets his team around him. That's what he's focused on. So maybe it's in his interest as well for this to be the way. So technically, Trump has still left office on the 20th of January. He can still be impeached, though. Still be impeached even after he's left office.
Well, some would have said horse, bolted, gates, perhaps in that order. But are we looking here at a smooth transition of power? Because so far, Chris, I mean, things are a little dicey right now.
I think we will see a smooth transition now. I think you have to remember the American elite, the American establishment, and the people who make up the American states, I mean, are very determined to achieve this. What we saw in those scenes with the storming of Congress was humiliating for America, and it will be used by its opponents around the world to point to the failures of American democracy. So they all been working really hard to try and make sure that this machinery now goes into place and we have a transition. The big question is, what is going to happen now in terms of the Republican Party? Is there going to be a fracture between those people who are denouncing Trump and Trump and his supporters? And are we going to see what till now has been a disparate far right in the United States, which hasn't really managed to get its act together? Is that possible now in the United States? Could a far right emerge as it has done across the Atlantic in much of Europe? These are interesting questions.
And very briefly, you touched on it there, Chris, the idea that Trump may be leaving, kicking or screaming, albeit, but Trumpism might be having a second win.
I think Trumpism, that is really the question. I fear that, as I say, these groups have been very disparate groups. They're fairly bonkers, fairly bad in many respects as well. But clearly, around issues of Islamophobia, about racism, around issues about democracy itself, there is the ground there for a ground on which a far-right organization could emerge. Now, what's Trump going to do? Is he just going to go quietly into the night? Even if he's in the process of being impeached, he's not barred from office, as I understand it. So It's possible Trump, and there are others as well, Rudy Giuliani, etc., who could emerge and see their chance as being given the focus to pull that far right together in the United States. That is going to be really a question. Can the far right build on what they've done so far in the United States?
Indeed. Chris Banbury, thank you. Watching that situation closely, of course. To some other news now, the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Mark Rutte, announced his country will be extended its COVID-19 lockdown by a further 3 weeks until February as the nation battles soaring infection rates. Under the new restrictions, the toughest yet imposed, schools and non-essential businesses will be closed, and people are being banned from having more than two additional people inside their homes. Earlier in the week, the country's health minister, Hugo de Jong, noted special concern for the British variant of the virus that is thought to be making up between 2 and 5% of Dutch infections. The Netherlands currently has some 883,000 confirmed cases, with just over 12,500 deaths. People in central Spain are struggling to cope in the aftermath of last weekend's heavy snowfall, which has now turned to ice and made roads and street safety hazardous. Temperatures plummeted to a record low of some minus 25.4 degrees Celsius in the town of Bayo, located in the east of Madrid. At least 7 people have died due to the inclement weather so far. Schools remain closed in the capital and much of central Spain, with emergency and military crews still working to reopen roads and distribute food and the coronavirus vaccine. The historic snowfall comes at a time when Spain continues to be battered by soaring COVID-19 rates. The country so far has registered 2 million confirmed cases, with nearly 52,000 deaths. Kasai Kedrib in Barcelona joins us now. Kasai, good to see that you're nice and cozy looking there at least. Is the weather affecting this fight against COVID, and how so?
Sure it does, Alina. The latest snowstorm did impact Spaniards in their daily lives in the sense that it did disrupt the traffic, and it also slowed down the movement of vaccines across the 17 regions, so much so that the central government was forced to deploy special convoys to keep the foodstuff moving between the regions and particularly ensure that the vaccines reach the 17 autonomous regions. It had to rely on the military to do so. And as you see on your screen, pictures there, the snow has hampered mainly the center of Spain, the capital. Here in Barcelona, there was no snow, and that difference is also impacting the reality of COVID. I live in Barcelona, so I live in Catalonia, not in Madrid, and that also is a different reality from Madrid. Here, there is cautious optimism as to the COVID-19 policy of the regional government. The restrictions are less tough than in other regions. Many of the 17 regions are stepping up restrictions ahead of the of what they consider as the upcoming third wave of the coronavirus. Here in Catalonia, there is cautious optimism. The health experts say there is no need for now to impose a total lockdown on the region, but they definitely consider more restrictions in the weeks ahead. One major decision that they will have to take on Friday is whether to cancel an upcoming regional election slated for mid-February. Otherwise, the vaccination is very slow in Spain, as you know, yes, due to disruptions and a lack of supply with regard to the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine. Today, Spain has received the first supply of Moderna vaccine, so that increases the chances that that it would reach the general public, but the government had to walk back its optimistic forecast of vaccinating and immunizing 70% of the population by the end of the summer. Now they are saying that this will not happen before 2022.
Well, we know all about broken promises here as it pertains to the vaccine. Good to see you, Kasai. Thank you very much. Now we move now to Turkey and Greece, because those countries have set a date for talks that might break a 5-year impasse over maritime boundaries and offshore energy resources. The EU has firmly taken the side of Athens in this dispute, drawing up a list of sanctions against Turkey, a move Ankara has labeled strategic blindness. Bianca Rahimi has more in this report.
Turkey has the longest continental coastline in the eastern Mediterranean and rejects the maritime boundary claims of Greece and the Greek Cypriot administration in the region. Ankara says these claims are excessive and violate the sovereign rights of both Turkey and Turkish Cypriots. The EU decided on punitive measures against Turkey last year after Ankara asserted its rights in the region by sending several drill ships to explore for energy on its continental shelf. However, the implementation of sanctions has been postponed until March, and Turkey says it is ready to get its relationship with the EU back on track in 2021.
We are inviting Greece, which has been increasing its airspace violations and unlawful activities in islands that are demilitarized, to give up their actions that are raising tensions. I believe that the exploratory talks with our neighbor Greece, which will start on the 25th of January, will, God willing, herald a new period.
European diplomats have signaled the dispute between Turkey and Greece is of paramount importance and also that progress has already been made.
What I have felt from my discussion with the minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu is progress has been made too, both in the way of relations between Turkey and Greece and in relations between Turkey and Cyprus and in relations between Turkey and France, to give you some examples.
Another issue high on the agenda for talks is Turkey's EU membership bid. Negotiations began in 2005, but have since come to a standstill. Erdogan says Turkey's membership will be a good thing for the EU, now Britain has left the bloc.
Uncertainties that are increasing with Brexit can only be dissipated with Turkey receiving its rightful place in the European family. We, as a country, are ready to put our relations back on track and create positive agendas with a long-term perspective.
In recent talks, Turkey has been quick to remind the EU of its dependence on Ankara when it comes to preventing hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants from trying to cross into European nations. Turkey says by taking initiatives in places like Syria and Libya, it is contributing to the EU's security considerably and is calling on the bloc not to allow disputes with individual members like Greece and France to jeopardize that. Bianca Rahimi, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Robert Carter, it seems Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is making some, well, quite damning accusations about, wait for it, Iran and Al-Qaeda. Are we talking here about woeful ignorance or willful propaganda?
Well, I can tell you exactly how the Iranians have responded to the claim. They've called it absolutely preposterous, Amina. And I have to say I agree with them, as does many other experts in the field. Anyone who knows anything about Iran or Al-Qaeda will know that these are lifelong enemies. Iran has played a key role in battling Al-Qaeda and defeating them on several fronts over the past sort of 10 years or so. We're talking about in Iraq, Syria, and elsewhere. Even in Lebanon, they've supported the fight against these radical Takfiri groups. Yet, for some reason and without any solid evidence to back up this claim, the US's Mike Pompeo has just thrown this accusation out there, and it's gone down very badly, both on social media and in the press. I actually have a clip which demonstrates Pompeo's accusation. Let's play that out now.
Al-Qaeda has a new home base. It is the Islamic Republic of Iran. As a result, bin Laden's wicked creation is poised to gain strength and capabilities.
Did you know Iran was on the grassy knoll when Kennedy was shot?
Well, Well, that's just one of the accusations which people have been bringing up sarcastically, so linking Iran to basically anything they want, given that Pompeo's doing exactly the same. People have been doing it online as well, just for a laugh, to kind of highlight the sheer hypocrisy and the joke behind these comments. I also have an old news article which portrays the founder of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, in very favorable terms. And this was written back in the time when Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen active in Afghanistan were supported by the US and were financed and supplied with arms to fight against the Soviet Union. So for Pompeo to claim that Iran is somehow best friends with Al-Qaeda, when actually, historically speaking, it was Washington who was rubbing shoulders with Osama bin Laden and so on, is an absolutely outrageous claim and a total joke, as we've realized. And that has been reflected on social media as well. I have two tweets which I think sum up this story very well, Amina. I'll go straight to the first. It's from Hadi Nasrullah, who says very straightforwardly, the US armed Al-Qaeda in Syria. Israel, a vital US ally, backed Al-Qaeda as well. Saudi Arabia and Qatar, both US client states, funded Al-Qaeda. But according to Pompeo, Iran is Al-Qaeda's new home. Are you kidding me? And then the second tweet I have from Assad here on the same line, saying that he added that Iran is also the new base of communism, jokingly, Nazism, and any ideology that the West ever abhorred. But Pompeo denied that he coordinated his discoveries with the head of Mossad, with whom he met yesterday. So the first part of the tweet was taking a little joke, a little jab at Pompeo there. But the second line was actually based on some truth. Pompeo coordinating
serious
with
there,
Mossad.
Rob. And something else that could be quite serious if you value your privacy. Your next story.
Yes, so moving on now. The free communication app, WhatsApp, has come under criticism and appears to have a mass exodus taking place as we speak after announcing new privacy policies that it's going to force on its members. And this, of course, has raised many questions about how secure are you on this WhatsApp network, and are they snooping in on your private chats and that sort of thing. So obviously people are turning to alternatives, other apps being downloaded instead, and WhatsApp has been forced to try and essentially do damage control to try and stop so many people leaving their service. WhatsApp, of course, owned by Facebook as well, which we know is a politicized social media platform which gags free speech for any group or individual that speaks out against Western US foreign policy, for example, the Palestinian cause. Iranian voices are being censored, and so many people fear that WhatsApp will just be an extension of that. And this, of course, is reflected on social media. I can go to the first tweet, which is from Will Cathcart, who actually represents WhatsApp and works for WhatsApp. He says, with end-to-end encryption, we cannot see your private chats or calls, and neither can Facebook. We're committed to this technology and committed to defending it globally. So trying to defend, do damage control there. However, criticism coming in thick and fast on social media. Ankit, who says, here is a clarification sent out by WhatsApp on the latest privacy concerns. However, in my experience, it is not entirely true. Each time I chat with a new person on WhatsApp, they are shown on my friend's suggestion on Facebook. Very suspicious. And Pratik has come out with a new viewpoint here, saying that WhatsApp is attempting to change the very basic definition of privacy. Since when is an individual's conversation with a business not private? If I go to a store and buy a product, is that supposed to be private information? Don't fall for the claptrap. So essentially saying that it'll probably blow over and it's not so serious. But many people disagreeing there. This is taken
indeed, nothing
very
is
bad
free. No such thing as a free lunch or a free app. Thank you, Robert Carter. Right, so Ireland's Prime Minister has said he would issue a formal state apology in Parliament after an inquiry found widespread mistreatment of women and children at so-called mother and baby homes. This is where thousands of infants died and were sometimes buried in mass graves. For most of the 20th century, these homes housed orphans, unmarried pregnant women, and their babies. Often the cultural shame meant that the level of care fell below expectations.
The report describes a dark, difficult, and shameful chapter of very recent Irish history, and a history that has had a very real and lasting consequences for many people. It holds up a mirror to aspects of our past which are painful and difficult, and from the present day perspective, often hard to comprehend.
The inquiry is part of a process of reckoning in the overwhelmingly Roman Catholic country to try and come to terms with a history of abuse in church-run institutions, including the shunning and shaming of unwed mothers, many of whom were pressured into giving up their babies for adoption. Perhaps, Robert Inlakesh, we should rename this the Pompeo half an hour, because there's more misdirection from the Secretary of State, in this case, Cuba.
Absolutely. A lot of people have been replying to what Mike Pompeo had stated online just around a day ago, now that the United States would reinstate Cuba on the state sponsors of terrorism list, which would, of course, pave way for more sanctions on Cuba. The U.S. Trump administration has, however, sanctioned Cuba despite this, the fact that they were taken off the list 5 years ago by the Obama administration. And, of course, under the Obama administration, there was a push to try and mend ties with Cuba, the former Soviet-backed adversary. Of course, we know about the Cuban Missile Crisis and what transpired there between the United States and Cuba. But now under Trump, we've seen with this push to try and get rid of Nicolas Maduro as the president of Venezuela, and the fact that Cuba has been backing Venezuela, that this is really a reaction to that and their failed attempt at a coup inside of Venezuela. A video that was released a few hours earlier by Mike Pompeo on his Twitter account.
We must defend unalienable rights today, because the International Human Rights Project is in crisis. Authoritarian governments, from China to Iran to Venezuela, are depriving our fellow human beings of their basic rights. Meanwhile, many multinational organizations have lost their way, focusing on partisan policy preferences while failing to defend fundamental rights.
And this is while his very own political allies decide whether to impeach his boss. He says that line without a shred of irony. What's been the social media reaction, Rob? Because I can't actually believe he said these things with a straight face.
Well, lots of social media reaction to the tweet which he released just 4 hours after that video, stating that they would yet again transfer Cuba, redesignate Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism, hence punish the people of Cuba. It's never about punishing governments, it's about punishing people. We've got the first one here from the head of Code Pink, Medea Benjamin, who says, "Disgusting hypocrites, Cuba is saving lives around the world with its medical missions. The U.S. is killing people with bombs. Who is the terrorist?" We've got another one here from a user called Sage, who says, "Trying to create alternative terrorism news to distract from the fact that your deplorable orange boss is being impeached for inciting terrorist murders."
Wow. I guess very briefly here, Robert, this is Mike Pompeo going out with a bang.
Absolutely, and it seems that Trump is going down a hardline neocon path, even to the very last day at the 11th hour, issuing orders like this. We saw the registration of Ansarullah as a terrorist organization, which will lead to an escalation of violence inside of Yemen and everything else
he's been doing. So much pain, so much sorrow, so little time, and that is where we leave both Robert Inlakesh and yourself for this broadcast.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. has always been a violent and polarized society with huge internal social tensions, as exemplified by its turbulent history of slavery, civil war, genocide against Native Americans, and civil rights mobilizations in 1950s and 60s. Despite the U.S. fixation on external threats, the biggest attack on American democracy came from within, says Marco Cornelis, writer, in an article published under the heading, U.S. Capitol Riots, The Biggest Threat to America is at Home. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. For at least three decades, the U.S. victory in the Cold War notwithstanding, American governments have overflowed with political statements and warnings highlighting how much the country and its democracy are under attack. Its freedom and interest, they argue, are threatened by Russian authoritarianism and cyber warfare, China's trade and technological war, state terrorism, and North Korean nuclear weapons. Even small and fragile states such as Serbia, Libya, and even Panama have been included in the extended U.S. definition of threat. On January 6th, however, it became far too evident that the biggest threat to U.S. democracy is internal, and it is represented by some of its own citizens. Images of the U.S. Capitol building being stormed by President Donald Trump's supporters on Wednesday, January 6th, offered a stark representation of this sad and embarrassing reality, which has not spared the U.S. from sarcastic comments highlighting its usual double standard. No Chinese wolf or cyber warrior or no Russian internet troll ever achieved what we watched outside and inside the Capitol in Washington on Wednesday, January 6th. The U.S. Congress recently approved another huge defense bill, vastly overshadowing both the country's friends and its foes. To ensure unparalleled military and intelligence capabilities around the globe, and yet sadly, it appears incapable of protecting even the headquarters of its own democracy. The unpreparedness of U.S. law enforcement and intelligence on Wednesday, January 6th, was unbelievable. A full investigation is urgently needed. After Pearl Harbor and 9/11, the events of January 6th mark the third dramatic example in less than a century in which the United States has shown such incredible weakness and negligence. Far too alert to external threats, the country is inconceivably blind towards internal ones. It is time to come to terms with an inconvenient truth. The United States has always been looking for external enemies, monsters to destroy, to keep at bay its internal ones. Trump's presidency and his supporters, whether deliberately or not, have finally ripped through this evil of hypocrisy. The U.S., unfortunately, has always been a violent and polarized society with huge internal social tensions, as exemplified by its turbulent history of slavery, civil war, genocide against Native Americans, and civil rights mobilizations in 1950s and 60s. For decades, the many good things the U.S. has provided a humankind's progress have obscured such original sins. But now the king is naked. A second civil war seems to be looming. The globalization and financialization of the economy in recent decades has caused an explosion of huge inequalities, which have also affected the white middle class. When such disparities affected only the black population and other minorities, a hypocritical business as usual mindset prevailed. But when the interests of the white middle America was also severely touched, the system started collapsing. The financial bubble exploded in 2008, heavily affecting wide segments of the society, including the white population. The revolt of deplorables began to brew, first with Sarah Palin in 2008 presidential race and the rise of the Tea Party, and then with the slow, unsettling metamorphosis inside the Republican Party. Former President Barack Obama, who was not helped by his Hamletic doubts and irresoluteness, tried to manage and heal such fractures, but sometimes legitimate anger, joined by lunatic conspiracy views, fueled by social media, prevailed and brought Trump to the White House. No matter how much effort the Washington's bloc, a term for the U.S. foreign policy and security establishment, put into distracting Americans with real or alleged external threats, the country's internal contradictions have prevailed. The COVID-19 pandemic and its dramatic economic and social consequences have further exemplified how broken the U.S. is and how unfairly it treats too many of its own citizens. Trump's presidency will be studied by legions of historians and scholars. The temptations to dismiss it as an aberration or temporary foolishness and to resume business as usual will be very high, but this would be a huge and unforgivable error. The 25th President of the United States has revealed only the tip of a far larger and very concerning iceberg. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're going to be discussing Warriors from the North, directed by Nasib Farah and Sorenstein Jespersen. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. and beside him is Masoud Shajara, who is the chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Now, Warriors from the North is a complex and multi-layered narrative that gives you a chilling insight into what fuels the current trend of Western Muslim youth leaving the West to join radical extremist groups abroad, such as Al-Shabaab, which is an Al-Qaeda-linked militant group in Somalia. The documentary tells the story of a Danish-Somalian boy in Copenhagen who fell victim to Al-Shabaab recruiters.
We were young men in our early 20s. We missed action. I was very attracted by being able to do something and stop being just one of them who's looked down on, you know. And now Mohammed's in Somalia. He's a warrior for Al-Shabaab. His father, Abukar, is afraid that his son will also become a suicide bomber.
I joined Al-Shabaab because I had nothing else to do and nothing left for it but to join.
We were a true group. We felt that Al-Shabaab showed us respect. I'd never experienced respect like that before.
And first of all, welcome both of you to the show. And Rich, as our guest film critic, what was your take on Warriors from the North?
Well, it's really, really well made, and it's got that kind of Danish filmmaking sheen to it. Beautifully shot. Very clever use of archival footage and stills, and I mean, they make a lot of use of videotape that they get of these warriors, kind of
so-called
really
warriors.
Chilling, yeah. Really chilling videotapes. And but then there's also a lot of footage shot in Copenhagen that's very beautifully shot, very cleverly put together. It's only an hour long. It's a short documentary, so it's not really a kind of comprehensive look at the situation. It's a very specific story about these specific people and their situation, even though it does have references to the larger story.
And for our viewers who haven't seen the film, in a nutshell, could you just briefly describe what it's about?
Basically, it centers on this man who calls himself the Shadow because he doesn't want to be identified. So you only see him as a shadow on screen, just his silhouette. And he tells his story about being a disaffected youth, basically had a bad breakup and tries to recover by partying and getting drunk, and of course his family doesn't approve of that, so he doesn't really have his family around him, and he's on his own, and he makes all these friends who take him into this closed circle and kind of groom him to go to Somalia, which is where he's from originally, but he hasn't been back there since he was a child. Mm-hmm. So and he tells the story quite coherently. You understand why he fell into this group. He loves the camaraderie of these other men, and then that group dissolved, but some of the men went to Somalia.
And we'll actually touch more on that.
And that's where the film veers. It follows one of his friends who has disappeared in Somalia, and the friend's father is trying to find him there. So you get that parallel story of the father trying to find his son.
Pretty much, essentially, that's what happens. We don't want to give too much away, but Masoud, I'd like your take on the documentary. As someone who works on tackling Islamophobia, did you have the same take as Rich?
No, I think the film didn't go out to be Islamophobic. I mean, I actually think it was quite clear that. But I think the environment and the way that the whole thing is within our society, it really came out that way because, you know, I, as the film was about the franchised sort of youth, getting involved and doing something which is unsavory, you know, say the least. But that happens to a lot of our youth, both Muslim and non-Muslim. And it really didn't tackle that, you know, that aspect. It's sort of what it sort of tackled is that here Islam, you know, it's give the perception that here was an Islam violent sort of thing, an output for them to go and do this. And, you know, the shots, for example, sort of having discussion in the mosque or having sort of discussion outside the shop with Arabic writing in the back and so forth, it really created that association. Mm-hmm. While in reality, the other side of the story was saying, really, this is not the case. This is just a bunch of youth who are really lost.
So you're saying there's multiple messages in this film?
It is, but I think that message was mixed up with some other messages which were sort of visual messages, and which is conflicting one another.
Well, that's a really good point, and I'd like to take a brief break now from the discussion. Rich, what did you make of this story and his struggle to bring back his son?
It's quite a wrenching story because he's really worried about his son. He knows that the life of one of these kids who goes to Somalia tends to last about 1 or 2 years before they're involved in some sort of bombing, which is just horrible to think about, for a father to think about his son being taken off there. He doesn't understand why his son even fell into this group. It's pretty wrenching. It's very intense. And also, the shadow, the other character, who was a good friend of Muhammad, is talking about his friend who's just gone, and he doesn't know what's happened to him.
And I think one of the interesting points about this father figure, who probably represents the voice of all the parents struggling to bring back their children who are lost to extremist groups, is that the father is nothing like his son. And I think many people might just be surprised to see that usually the idea is that the children become radicalized by their parents. But this isn't the case, is it, Masood?
No, I think this is where I think the documentary failed. Although it was giving messages that strengthened that, but it failed to actually say that, you know, this conveyor belt sort of that is sort of usually talked by British government and other governments, that, you know, people start one side and then eventually they become radicalized at the end, which has been disputed by all academics and indeed by intelligence services, but it still is being pushed as a basis of our anti-terrorism sort of strategy. It's not factual, it's actually false. And, you know, this guy, if anything, was quite a misguided group of people, very alienated, all of them, and out of boredom and alienation of where they were actually dragged into that arena. And this was, it was a fact, but wasn't really strengthened.
But this documentary is about the personal stories of the individuals, not so much addressing the politics of the situation.
No, but you see, it's very difficult not to, you know, because at the end of the day, that is what makes this very moving. And you know, for example, many of other youth in our society, they might not be Muslim, they might go and join a gang, and they actually end up going as much wrong as these guys gone. And that
is
something.
Or they get into a right-wing group that commits atrocities at home.
I mean, this is, you know, is really a challenge for our society to, first of all, to understand this phenomenon, and then to address it, if possible. And this is sort of, did not actually reach that, look, these youth, although they got involved in this thing, but they were no different to other youth in the society who gets misguided and out of boredom and of nothing to do, and of the fact that, you know, I mean, they were saying that was a group of them coming together, it was a family for them. So there was something really lacking in the society.
Rich, would you agree with Masood, what he's saying there, that this documentary should have given more context to what's happening?
I mean, I think since it's just a one-hour documentary, it's very short, and I think they were specifically trying to tell this one story. But they do bring in stories from other people. They have the one, there's the extensive video clips of the boy who went from the UK to Somalia, and then he got out of Al-Shabaab. And I wish they had replaced that story with another story of someone in Denmark who found the family in his mosque and didn't, you know, and found what he was missing, you know. And I thought that was what was missing in the film, was the story of someone who found the positive side of Islam, the peaceful side, and, you know, and didn't succumb to violence, which isn't really part of Islam.
Well,
and the film does make that clear. It makes it clear that this violence and these kind of, you know, bombers are not actually Islamic. That's not part of Islam.
I think that's a really important point, that you make that point. And I'm afraid we'll just have to pause it just for now.
Joshua looked for vulnerable young teenagers who had problems with their families, who had problems with the government, who have issues with police, who are easy target for Al-Shabaab, because the person's mind is already crafted and believed, you know, in his own mind, He doesn't trust the police, but the police are the ones that are locking him up and putting him in jail. He doesn't really trust his family because his family doesn't give him enough support. So what does he do? He becomes fooled, like me. He joins Al-Shabaab, ends up being killed himself.
You really get a sense of how alienated and isolated these young Somalis feel in Denmark. Rich, do you think this documentary was successful in outlining the reasons why these young Danish Somalis go and fight for Al-Shabaab?
It kind of hints at the situation in Europe, where a Somali, young Somali teenagers are treated like outsiders, so they don't feel like they belong in the society where they've grown up. And these young men have grown up in Denmark, but they don't feel Danish. And they don't really feel Somalian either, because they never lived there, really. So they feel like they don't have any home. And it does really convey that idea. I don't know what's the answer to that. We need to have more open societies that accept people. And maybe the trick is to target prejudice and these ideas that the general public have that marginalize groups of people. But that happens on every level of society, not just ethnically. And
yeah, no, of course. I saw you nodding your head there, Masood. Would you agree with what Rich just said?
Yes, I think our society is much more complicated than one issue results in one thing. You know, it's not as simple as that. Alienation is one aspect. And the other aspect is that these are the youth who, some of them came across the way that they were being interviewed. They were concerned about the injustices around the world. And they wanted to do something about it, which is a very amicable feeling to have. But instead of that feeling being strengthened and supported in the right way of addressing those things, the only thing they could find was actually going and being recruited by these guys. And that is actually a failure that I see in our society day in, day out. And indeed, the government policies and so forth exaggerate this. And the reality is that there are forcing us not to be political, not to address these issues, not to talk. The elephant in the room is being ignored. And the reality is that these youth, and indeed the other youth, are not given the right tools to be, activists in a real sense for the right thing, for the right reason, and with the right tools. And if you remove that from any youth, you're actually leaving open very negative aspect to sneak in, because youth want to do something. They want to be part of a solution. And I think we're failing them in that way. And the other aspect is that we are giving wrong messages as a society. We actually tell, through our policies overseas and things, we're actually giving a message that end justifies the means. And that message ultimately is a terrorist justification. And if we give that message could be interpreted and used in other arenas, and people go towards these sort of extreme ways of addressing something which is very, very noble.
And Rich, I get the sense from this documentary that the filmmakers are trying to, while not necessarily directly sympathize with the recruits, but and at the same time they're condemning and showing how horrific their crimes are. Are you getting that sense that the recruits are victims in their own right as well?
Yeah, the film clearly presents them as victims. It presents them as good children who have been brainwashed and kind of convinced that this is the way that they should act and mm-hmm. what they should do. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a sense that it's presenting them as it's not their fault. They're 16-year-olds who have been convinced that what they're doing is the right thing to do, and it does. I mean, our discussion is going way beyond the material in the film, because it is a short film and it is very concentrated on this very specific story.
And that's
story.
A merit to the film, because it raises
it
many
does,
serious
it,
questions.
It causes you to think about these things that it doesn't really address, and that's quite important.
And we're going to talk about sort of the vulnerability issue of these recruits.
At one time, I was very seductive to doing this thing. I sort of believed in it for a moment, and I was ready at one time in my life. I used to think that killing is okay, that, wrapping yourself up with suicide bomb and exploding yourself in the midst of 10,000 people or something was okay. Until I got to a certain level, and I saw that it was wrong. Endless
non-stop killing for no reason. When I saw more civilians dying than actual soldiers here in Somalia, that's when I stopped being Al-Shabaab. I wish there's something I can do to stop from all these other kids from getting fooled by the same way I got fooled, you know, being tricked into this endless killing, you understand? I want to change.
Was Mohammed Ali Omar there in that clip, and he's in hiding in Somalia but wishes to return to Europe. And Rich, are there many options for people like him if they wish to return? Because I think he fears of being prosecuted.
Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know what the legal situation for someone like that is. I don't know if he would be, I don't know what he's done. Has he
done
anything
illegal? But in the film,
does it
show that path at all?
Yeah, and the film doesn't really go into that. I found myself wishing that was a separate documentary about him, because I think his story is quite interesting, and it's more hopeful because it does have it's not finished yet because he is in hiding, but it's a fascinating story to me, and I think, you know, I'm hoping some documentary filmmaker watches this and thinks, and goes and finds him and tells his story,
and maybe helps him
reintegrate into European society.
Mm-hmm. And Nasir, following from that clip, how is it that young people, and you talked about it earlier, how this film doesn't explain why they're being tricked or how. Could you help explain why and how they're being tricked into mosques and joining extremist groups?
Well, really, it's difficult to say exactly how it's happening, but as I said, there are a number of issues.
Is it that they're taking a literalist interpretation of Islam, perhaps Wahhabism?
Well, what we know that, and this film touches on that, that actually the most ignorant of Islam youth are the ones who actually get recruited. One recruit from Britain, he actually ordered Islam for dummies, you know, just before going. So this is not something that is motivated by Islam. But unfortunately, our way of combating it is all geared towards we've got to find out this Islam and change it. And unfortunately, one thing which I really felt it was wrong in the film, it gives two alternatives. One for the youth to go and be a terrorist, and the other one was actually going to club. And the third option wasn't there. I mean, you didn't look at hundreds and thousands of youth who are Muslim, who are practicing Muslim, who are great contributors. And this stereotyping, unfortunately, is very damaging. I think also the reality is that, you know, on one side, the end justifies mean policy, which West has been pursuing, is the problem. And the other thing is actually, we have got involved from the West with the Saudi regime in creating a new version of Islam for our political sort of needs in the Middle East region. And this is how backfired. It backfired in Afghanistan, is backfiring now, is backfiring in Syria. And out of that, it actually comes these sort of horrifying ideology of killing everyone, and which it's now interpreted that these are Muslims killing non-Muslims, but the reality is that groups like Daesh are killing more Muslims than non-Muslims, but they're killing everyone and justifying it by Islam, which is social engineered as a foreign policy with the help of our Saudi partners.
Well, that's definitely way outside of the film, but thank you for the explanation. But I think the filmmakers in this documentary are saying it's easy to write off these groups of people, but I think they want to make viewers think that what role do the West play in radicalizing these individuals? Is that one of the messages?
I think so. Yeah, I think there is that message about why are these kids just left to fall through the cracks of the society? Why is their only option to either become radicalized or go out clubbing and getting drunk? Why are they left like that? It doesn't really examine that. It kind of raises the issue to think about, and I kind of wish it had. But then, that's another film. So.
Mm-hmm. And final thought for 30 seconds to you, Masood. Would you recommend that people see this film? I know it's only an hour long, and it raises many questions. But as a starting point, perhaps.
I do, but I say again, you know, some of the visuals conflicted with the. With the messages it was given. So, you know, different people could watch it and come up with different things. I could imagine very clearly some Islamophobes and extreme right will see it, and it will be justification for all their and visions.
So it's open to interpretation,
I'm not
guess.
I'm not sure about that. It does come up fairly strongly about how immoral the actions of these suicide bombings are.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there, but we could keep talking all day. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks for tuning in. I've been Camila Shambiati.